This is Michael Silverblatt. Today's Bookworm Show may contain spoilers about Edward St. Aubyn's new novel, Double Blind.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And this is Bookworm. You've just heard a theme song written by the brothers Mail, who are Sparks, who are among my favorite people. And this is a glorious day because I'm about to talk to one of my other favorite people. That is Edward St. Aubyn. His newest book, Double Blind, was a source of great fascination to me. I'm enjoying thinking about it, and we're about to experience a conversation about a wonderful book that isn't, it seems to me, what anyone thinks it is. I've been reading reviewers. Some of them love the book, some of them hate the book, but to my mind, none of them understand the book. What I mean is there's more there than meets the eye, and it was constructed in that way. Edward St. Aubyn, whose nickname is Teddy, may I call you Teddy?
Yes, please, Michael. Of course.
How did you conceive this book? What were its origins?
Well, I think that I've had a long fascination with the problem of consciousness. I went to a conference in 1996 called Towards a Science of Consciousness, and I was very struck by the fact that consciousness, which is the only thing we know we have and the basis of everything else we think we know, is something that is not included successfully in science's majestic description of the world. And I wondered whether that explanatory gap extended to other parts of science. So at the end of the 90s, I wrote a book called A Clue to the Exit, which was a short book and a strange book in which there was a first-person narrative and a third-person narrative, which was embedded within it, which was an attempt to give form to the subject matter, which is that experience will not be reduced to experiment, and that experiment refuses to include experience. And this tension between a first-person description of the world and a third-person description seemed irreconcilable. And this problem went on bugging me and expanded over time. And the Melroses rather eclipsed the books in which I'd engaged with it in the 90s. And so I'm really returning, in a sense, to an old worry. You know, all my books are about what I can't get off my mind. And after finishing the Melroses, this is what I couldn't get off my mind.
Well, it was fascinating to me, and the word you used, irreconcilability, seems to be the key word in this book, Double Blind. There's a large cast of characters. For the most part, they are scientists, sometimes humanists, sometimes technological scientists, and they're all intelligent in conventional ways. But intelligence doesn't free them from their opinions. It's almost a farce of a cast of characters, all of whom are always expressing themselves and not quite noticing that what they're saying is irreconcilable with everything that everyone they're talking to believes. And these irreconcilabilities become the tone of the book, the tone of its comedy, and the tone of its sadness. Because sometimes you have characters who are essentially improvising, making up crazy ideas. There are helmets in this book which, being worn, make you happy, happy helmets. And the brainwaves inside this helmet are taken from a spiritual man who has not spoken to another human being in years, but lived in solitude.
Yes, the happy helmet is... I mean, to some extent, the whole book is about materialism and its discontents, you know, and the idea that we can shop our way to happiness is the most obvious and superficial level of that materialism. But as a philosophy, of course, it goes deeper and leaves a lot of explanatory gaps in our vision of the world, you know, and leaves us in this alienated relationship to the world.
Now, am I right in considering that the tragedies of this book have been constructed the way you construct a farce? From time to time, this book brings together all of its improbable characters for parties and festivities at which their misapprehensions reign supreme.
I think that that's absolutely true of the mosaic chapters in the books, the ones which are made up of dropping into one mind and then another because they're gatherings or parties. And I think they are completely ruled by a farcical spirit of misunderstanding, particularly the party in the south of France, which is seen to a great extent through the eyes of the innocent Father Guido.
Father Guido has been sent to get the millionaire who's intending to profit on these happy helmets, to get that millionaire to recognize that since the consciousness within the helmet comes from within the Catholic Church, that the profits should be shared. In other words, we're watching what is inevitably true. We're watching, however obscure, we're watching science become potential for human profitableness. And relatively speaking, the main characters in the book are to different extents innocents, not as innocent as Guido and not as innocent as the book's schizophrenic character, Sebastian, but they are struggling with a world that's threatening to subsume them in every imaginable way so that their ideals are going to emerge time-worn, whitewashed, and impossible to attain.
Yes, that's absolutely true. But through his innocence and his misunderstanding, Father Guido somehow navigates his way to a state of revelation during this party. And he's a Franciscan, and he meets up with Francis, who's a kind of rewilding ecologist at the end of that chapter, and they have a moment of communion, you know, in which they've both in their separate chapters come to a roughly speaking panpsychist position, in which they think that everything must be conscious, or in the case of Father Guido, everything must be sacred, as the solution to the dualistic, alienated, materialist problem that is presented through the novel at various points in various ways. And if everything is permeated with consciousness rather than consciousness being some sort of inexplicable epiphenomenon arising out of a cold, dead universe, then the problem is solved.
Just as Guido is a Franciscan meeting Francis. There's a great comedy of names in this book, and so a brother and a sister will meet, and their names are names drawn from Twelfth Night. And so when they finally meet, it's as if destiny and literature have conspired to bring them together.
Yes, the Twelfth Night is in the background. It's not brought into the foreground at any point, but it's certainly there, yes.
I'm talking, by the way, to Edward St. Aubin, the author of the Patrick Melrose novels, and his most recent book is called Double Blind. And it's a fascinating title because all of these characters are in their way double blind. And more than that, the reader is too in a double blinded experiment. The truth is unknown both to the scientist and to his patient. Some of them are receiving sugar pills, just mere proxies for a solution, and others are being given an actual pill that is being tested and might work. This lays waste to the concept that there is such a thing anywhere as a control group. And what the reader finds, what I found, what as I read the book, that I was consistently being shuttled from one idea to another that would engage me in the possibility that this is the truth, but this might be yet another proxy. I don't know of any other novel that uses unreliability in this hilarious and massive way. A novel, say Lolita or The Good Soldier, may have an unreliable narrator, but this, the idea of reliability, is itself put to question. What do you think, Ted?
I think that's very insightful, and it's so insightful that I'm almost thrown by it, because the depth of the unreliability is something that I didn't know I'd achieved. But since the whole novel is questioning various kinds of scientific methodologies and various kinds of materialistic assertions and other philosophical assertions, and I wanted them all to be left in doubt, but in a kind of informed doubt. I think your remark is true. On the other hand, I do think there is a kind of possibility of regeneration that's in the background of this book that is not treated satirically or farcically. You know, there is the possibility of Sebastian the schizophrenic having what has always been taken to be nonsense treated as a meaningful symbolic language by his psychoanalyst Martin Carr. And there's the possibility of the rewilding project in Sussex, giving the land a rest from human intervention and from the sort of defibrillator of artificial fertilizer being poured on a pile of dust in order to yield one more crop of some monocultural.
Let me tell you something, Teddy, and this is something I'm going to tell my listeners as well. I spent a good deal of time in psychoanalysis, and the moving quality of this book involves a schizophrenic character, Sebastian, as you say, being taken seriously by his psychoanalyst. Now, all my life, I was regarded as someone who spoke nonsense simply because others didn't understand, and so they called it nonsense. In this book, we watch a schizophrenic come to something not of a recovery, but an access to being, as the book says, a grown boy. I had the great blessing of having a psychoanalyst who studied with the man who helped Samuel Beckett break his writing block, a psychoanalyst who's since attained great fame around the world, named Wilfred Bion, and my doctor studied with him. Since Beckett was my god in terms of writing, I felt that not only was I being taken seriously, I was being taken seriously by a man who had known, who had studied with a man who had taken Beckett seriously enough. As I understand it, whenever Beckett tried to write, he would break out in rashes, and so it was his mother who sent him to London to see a psychoanalyst who turned out to be a young, newly practicing doctor named Wilfred Bion. And in this book, the psychoanalyst who is capable of hearing stands in for what the reader must do to take in what might be nonsense as serious revelation, and to take in the seriousness of these blabbering scientists as nonsense.
Everyone in this book is in a divided state, in a kind of schizoid state, in a schizoid culture. Sebastian is just the most extreme example of that. He's sort of dualism gone viral. So in a sense, he's one of the purest, along with Guido, characters in the book, because he's not successfully, like people who allege to be sane, compartmentalizing the contradictions which are bombarding him the whole time. And so in some ways, he's leading an honest life. But he's leading an honest life which no one has understood until he starts to talk to his psychoanalyst. And like you, I've had two great psychoanalysts who've helped me immensely. And I suppose one of the features of this book is that I've been prepared to take things which have been very important to me privately and put them front stage in a novel, rather than very indirectly, as in the Melrose series, where Patrick's best friend, over the five books, gradually turns into a psychotherapist. But he's like a confidant until then. He's a sort of buddy who turns into a confidant, who turns into a psychotherapist. But he's there as to represent that kind of presence. But I wanted to try and write about, you know, the real value of being understood in that way, which I'm very glad is something you know about. And what a distinguished source. I'm Beckett's psychoanalyst's disciple. It's strange you should mention Beckett. He's so important to me.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Edward St. Aubyn about his new book, Double Blind, which I found fascinating and mysterious and a source of revelation in the possibilities of structuring a novel. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Edward St. Aubin about his new book, Double Blind, a perfect expression of the interconnections it sets out to examine. It seemed to me that one of the things the reader must do in this book is distinguish the difference between sincerity and honesty, to see which of the characters are simply naive in their incorrectness, and which of them are controlling and dangerous. The book interrupts itself for scenes of immense comedy before returning to its characters, all of whom have been subjected to abnormal dangers, especially the two women, one of whom who has been diagnosed with a potentially fatal condition. And the book seemed to me to be a vast comedy of putting the reader into false directions and constantly challenging the reader. I felt that this book was perpetually just slightly above my head. Were these scientific explanations to be taken seriously? They're certainly written profoundly and provide great difficulty for the reader. And afterwards, you see that this has been a shield by the scientists to come between the reader and the scientists' loss of feeling and identity. I have never read a book like this before, but I'm very grateful to be talking to its author, Edward St. Aubin, because I haven't the faintest idea whether the things I felt about this book were true. The book is so exciting that it slightly takes pleasure in eluding you.
Yes, well, the great difficulty that I had in trying to master all this, to me, alien knowledge about science, I tried to spare the reader from. But inevitably, I wanted to present the science as accurately as possible, and I've had it checked and checked with an autodidact's paranoia. The science in the book is true, and it's some of it is controversial, but that all of it is defensible, and all of it is deeply researched. In order to keep presenting these possibilities offered by neuroscience, or offered by genetics, or offered by ecology, I did have to understand them to a certain point, but none of them is entirely satisfactory. And I think your remark about not knowing is absolutely accurate. I think that the novel, I hope, leaves you resting in not knowing, as it were, lying comfortably in the hammock of our ignorance about a lot of deeply mysterious subjects, including consciousness, which is the only thing we have direct access to. Yes, at the intellectual level, I think that's where we end up resting in not knowing. But at an emotional level, I do think there is a little more progress than that, which we've already touched on in the case of Sebastian, who goes from being, you know, the most troubled character. It's very difficult to be Sebastian, but he's able to more or less put up with it by the end of the novel, and that was very touching to me. I actually wrote the end of the novel crying, but not that anyone else needs to, but I agree with your analysis of the novel and it's very refreshing to talk to someone who's understood it so deeply.
It's rare to find a novel that, to my mind, is shaped like a farce of incompatible ideas at simultaneously providing the room for the human breakdown in which the gap between different kinds of knowing erupts into human rather than learned behaviors. And I found the book very moving. As my friend Donald Barthelme said, the essence of reading and writing is in not knowing. Not knowing is where the excitement in writing comes from. You know, people have been saying that this book is extraordinarily well planned. I think it's a set of brilliant improvisations that are experimentally placed next to one another to see what will happen, and that the book is constantly surprising itself by the emergence of what resides between very different points of view. And I found the reading experience to be a thrilling one.
I love your point of view on this novel, and it is all improvised. I never plan a novel. I make it up as I go along.
I've been talking with Edward St. Aubin, author of Double Blind, a thrilling new novel published here by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Teddy, for joining me again. I really always look forward to talking to you.
I love talking to you, Michael. Thank you for having me on the show. A great pleasure.
It's been my great pleasure. I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping remotely. Usually we'd be face to face, and you may hear different unusual sounds coming from within our separate environments. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. It can also be listened to on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to Bookworm show collaborators Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, who serve as my guide and my guarantors of the coherence of what we do here, which is all also improvised. Engineer PJ Shahamat has been on the board today, and I'm thrilled to have him. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.